Welcome, one and all, to another installment of the George Sanders Show. Today, tying in with Woody Allen's new film, Blue Jasmine, which is opening in limited release this week, we planned on talking about two films set in San Francisco. Unfortunately, we got some bad intel, courtesy of Wikipedia. Thanks,
as,
Sean.
As usual.
As usual. So only one of the films that we were talking about is actually set in San Francisco, and that is Sneakers, Phil Alvin Robinson's thriller from 1992. We are also talking about Otto Preminger's 1949 film Whirlpool.
Which it does have one scene set in San Francisco.
It's an interior shot of someone receiving a phone call in San Francisco. So, you know, if we're talking,
technically, that list is correct.
Technically, that list is correct. We'll also be talking about the career of Robert Redford and our Cinema Essential picks for best computer hacker films, which is going to be super fun.
Oh, definitely.
I think we both picked Hackers with Angelina Jolie.
I picked Virtuosity.
I picked Johnny Mnemonic. Without further ado, though, let's get this ball rolling with a discussion of Sneakers.
So, here,
before we begin, there's something we'd like to clear up. Most firms of this type are staffed with ex-law enforcement types, but your team, it's,
I know, kind of different. Yes, you are. Darren Roscoe, also known as Mother. 18 months at Denimore for breaking and entering.
Yeah, he was framed. He's got the best hands in the business.
Carl Arbogast, age 19, caught breaking into the Oakland City School District computer to change his grades.
I know. We're the ones who caught him.
Erwin Emery, also known as Whistler.
Yeah, I know. He had some little problem with the phone company.
62 counts.
Okay, you want law enforcement? How about Donald Kreese, 22-year veteran of the CIA?
Terminated, 1987. Why was that?
I don't know. I think maybe a personality conflict. Who are you guys?
Relax, Marty. We have to check on these things. It's just everybody on your team has had some sort of problem in their past.
And then there's Martin Bishop. He doesn't seem to have a past.
Okay, that was a clip from Sneakers. The film stars Robert Redford as a man with a shadowy past who heads this group that tests security in banks and other institutions, basically breaking into them to make sure that they can't be broken into. And he gets pulled into this plot with the NSA, ostensibly the NSA, which makes this kind of a timely movie for us to be talking about 20 years later, who they have shady motives for enlisting him to acquire this device that can decrypt any computer software.
Yeah, it's a little black box that somewhat mathematically can break any code, but only codes in the U.S.
Only
because,
codes in the U.S.
Because other countries' codes are based on different math, apparently.
Yes. it's a silly movie, you know, but it's a lot of fun, or at least I found it a lot of fun. My experience with this film goes way, way back to when it opened in 92. I've seen Sneakers, oh gosh, probably 10 times, and it was all, you know, when I was 11 years old until I watched it again today. So it was a really strange experience for me revisiting it because, especially the first hour, the first half of the movie, I remembered everything. I mean, every little, you know, line of dialogue, every, you know, wry look from Robert Redford, you know, little things like that. The whole thing was just, I mean, it was just a time warp right back to being 11 years old. And I loved this movie so much as a kid that I used to, inspired by the film, I lived in a suburb of a suburb in the Bay Area, tying that in with the show. I lived in Foster City, California, which is the promised land. If you've never been there, you should definitely make a pilgrimage. And I used to go on my bike with my younger brother, and there was an office building where my dentist was housed, and it was a couple blocks from our house. And my brother and I used to walk through the halls, and we found a way to get on the roof and stuff, and we were we would play Sneakers, where we would pretend like we were spying on people. But you know, we were only spying on dentists. But this movie had a profound effect on me as a kid, and it was really an interesting experience to rewatch it. How did you have an experience with Sneakers?
Yeah, I'm older than you. I was 16 when it came out, but it was definitely a movie I watched and watched over and over again on HBO. And
yeah, it was on all the time.
Yeah, and I had the same experience. I haven't watched it in 15 years or so, but you know, I instantly remembered every little detail and bits of dialogue and the various inflections of the actors' voices.
Yeah,
I got the anagram wrong initially when they're working out they get some Scrabble tiles,
yeah,
and they're like working out the title of this secretive company to try and figure out what it means.
You thought the rat semen one was the correct one, didn't you?
I thought it was No More Secrets, but then that didn't have a Y. It's actually Too Many Secrets.
Too Many Secrets.
But then No More Secrets is a recurring phrase later on in the film.
It is, yes. Possibly this movie is what I credit with my love of anagrams.
And Scrabble.
I do love a good Scrabble game. We used to play Scrabble all the time. At work, and we worked hard over at the movie theater.
Yes, indeed.
Sean was my most formidable foe in Scrabble, but it was, you know.
That's not saying much. I was terrible at Scrabble.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm terrible at Words with Friends. I can play Scrabble just fine, but Words with Friends, I just get slaughtered. I don't
play games on my phone.
Yeah,
it's for business.
But business, says the stay-at-home dad. But anywho, back to Sneakers. Actually, tying it in with the anagrams, I did post a review this morning of Sneakers on Letterboxd on my profile, Utter Piffle. The first person to crack the code of the anagram of my review, which is, it's an anagram for a line of dialogue in the film. If someone can crack it, the first person to crack it and either tweet us at Geo Sanders Show or email us at thegeorgesandersshow@gmail.com, that person will get a pick a film for us to discuss somewhere down the line.
Oh my.
Any movie they want. But it's going to be a hard one to crack.
Okay.
Yeah, and no using little black boxes. Anyway.
If I crack it, can I pick the movie?
Absolutely. You can totally do it, Sean.
All right.
But anyway, back to the film. So yeah, seeing it now, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't notice how political this movie is. I mean, you know, political in scare quotes. You know, I mean, it's got the makes jabs at George H.W. Bush, and it definitely feels like a movie from 1992.
Yeah, it's. I actually think it is pretty political that it Redford's character, the film starts with a flashback to him in his youth during the Nixon administration, where he's like a college student hacking into the Republican Party's accounts and stealing their money,
mm-hmm,
and giving it to charitable organizations. So he's like this youthful radical, which is, you know, and fitting with the film's San Francisco setting, you know, with the Berkeley and Bay Area, it's,
mm-hmm,
a very kind of liberal, lefty city. It's a symbol of the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely.
And then later on, the kind of actors in his group are all kind of are symbolic of kind of counterculture baby boomerism. There's Redford himself, who's an outspoken liberal activist. There's also Sidney Poitier. And Dan Aykroyd from Saturday Night Live has kind of a symbol of like anarchic baby boomer humor. And then there's, you know, David Strathairn, who's in a lot of John Sayles movies, are very politically committed, and he's also playing this blind guy that's like this kind of magical vision of how, you know, wonderful handicapped people are.
Magical vision, is that pun intended? Yeah,
I think a lot of the film is kind of a baby boomer wish fulfillment of this, you know, multicultural group of men,
mm-hmm,
and one woman who plays a subordinate role.
Yes, she's kind of coerced into doing her part,
which kind of gets at a lot of contradictions in the kind of the new left of the 60s and 70s, and that it's very not closely tethered to reality and also tended to ignore women.
You're right. I mean, those were conscious decisions to have those people play those characters, and those characters themselves are, you know, archetypes. And don't forget River Phoenix. I mean, the kid's name is River.
River Phoenix is like, he's like the honorary Gen X baby boomer.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
but I think, you know, I think all that stuff doesn't really matter when watching Sneakers for the most part. It's mostly just the fun of, you know, them breaking. Particularly, I actually think the first hour is the best hour of Sneakers. I think the second half kind of falls a little flatter, at least on this most recent viewing.
Yeah, you know, it's a caper heist film, and there are, you know, two or three, I think, big heist sequences, and they're, you know, they're suspenseful and they're reasonably well put together. They're not wholly plausible.
But we can get to that later. I don't even know if they're even close to being plausible.
But we can talk about that later. But I think, you know, like, the motivations of the characters don't make sense outside the political context.
Yeah.
Because, like, the ultimate villain is, I think we can spoil it, it's 20 years old. It's Ben Kingsley, who was Robert Redford's partner,
right,
in Youthful Crime. And
who gets nabbed back then.
Right. He gets caught by the police, and Redford gets away because Redford went out for pizza.
Yeah.
And he eventually becomes like an accountant for the mob, and then he wants to steal this device in order to fulfill their youthful anarchic dream of bringing down the capitalist system.
Right. Making everybody equal.
Right.
You know, by no money.
Erasing a history of ownership.
Right.
And that's his motivation. And his motivation for not, you know, killing Redford every time he has the chance, because he's a, you know, ruthless, power-mad, crazy guy, and he could easily steal the box and kill everyone and nobody would ever catch him.
Right.
He doesn't want to do that because he wants Redford to join him, because he wants, you know...
He wants to relive his glory days.
Right. He wants to bring back the 1960s idealism.
Yes.
In the destruction of the capitalist system.
While wearing a button-down shirt with no tie and rocking a ponytail.
Yeah, and I bet Ben Kingsley is a great actor. He's one of the great actors of the last half century or so. But his accent in this movie is terrible. Like, it's somewhere between his accent in Gandhi and his accent in Schindler's List.
Yeah, it's an odd choice.
It's not reflective of any American dialect I know of.
Yeah, it's very slippery. Kind of like his character.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, yeah, well, going back to that, I mean, he doesn't show up in the movie until about an hour in. And that's when all the, you know, the lies, you know.
He's revealed as the puppet master behind the scenes.
Which is no surprise. I mean, you can guess that's coming a mile away from seeing that opening scene. And yeah, it just, that's when the moralizing comes in. Or, you know, for me, my favorite heist, what's your favorite heist in the film?
Probably the opening one in the bank.
Exactly. That's the best one.
It's the tightest one.
Yeah. It's the most fun. You don't. I think part of it is you don't know that they're, you know, breaking into this bank to, you know, give the money back, or you don't know any of the motivations. You just see these guys doing this thing, and it's just fun, and that's how it is. Later, it just gets more and more convoluted and silly.
Yeah, there are plausibility problems with the other two main heists, and. Alfred Hitchcock used to talk about this disdainfully. The people in the audience who were always like, well, why would that person do that? That doesn't make sense. Why didn't they just call the police? And he would call them the plausibles. And I hate to be a plausible, but this movie brought out the plausibleness in me.
Yeah.
Like, there's the initial stealing of the little black box, where the mathematician who's invented this box that can decode any code in the United States just leaves it on his desk in his...
Hidden, you know, in an answering machine.
Yeah.
What? But why?
Just, you know, in this normal apartment building with, like, one little lock that can easily be kicked in.
Yeah.
And it's just sitting there.
Just sitting there.
No guard. No
security. And the blind guy is the guy that found it.
Right. The scientist, by the way, is played by Donald Logue, which when my wife and I, you know, realized that, giggled with glee. We were big fans of the series Terriers. I don't know if you saw Terriers.
I didn't see Terriers.
Got canceled long before its time, but Donald Logue was the star of that, and he's terrific. He's also in a movie called The Dawood Steve.
Oh, that's that guy.
Yeah.
I didn't even recognize him.
In Sneakers, he wears an all-white suit and shirt, and he has, like, shoulder-length hair.
It's truly 1992.
Yeah, he looks like a distant cousin of Crispin Glover or something. But he is still Donald Logue.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, I didn't even notice that. The face seemed familiar, though. But
anyway, so he's got this box and it's just sitting there, and it's ridiculously easy for Robert Redford to steal it. And the only complication in the heist comes when Logue's girlfriend shows up randomly.
Mm-hmm.
The third heist is much more complex, but there's all kinds of like little things from like why would they do that? He's stealing the box out of Ben Kingsley's office, and it's got these motion detectors hanging from the ceiling. But there's a blind spot
right in the corner. Yeah.
And right above the blind spot is the vent opening into the office. So I'm like, why not put the motion detectors in the other corner where there isn't the vent opening?
Right. Maybe or push them against the wall.
Yeah.
You know, why not put them against the wall? Yeah, that part really raised my eyebrow, too.
When the alarm goes off and they get caught, like, the building is instantly flooded with dozens of soldiers. You see them, like, running all through the building. And then 5 minutes later, after, you know, Ben Kingsley has this great line, you know, I can't kill my friend, and points to Timothy Busfield and says, kill my friend.
Yeah.
And then walks away. Before he's killed, of course, because this is Hollywood,
right.
And bad guys never watch the heroes get killed.
Right.
And then Robert Redford escapes, and no soldiers are anywhere in the building anymore.
They're gone.
These dozens of people that have been clogging every hallway have suddenly disappeared.
Yeah.
In like 3 minutes.
Yeah. No, it's totally ridiculous. Well, and then, you know, Whistler, David Strathairn, drives a truck.
that I'm okay with.
Well, he's going full speed and he crashes into a wall, and it's, you know, everything's fine. It's ludicrous.
It's kind of silly.
But that's okay.
Because I always really liked how they recreate where the location of Ben Kingsley's office from the sounds that Robert Redford heard when he's hidden in the trunk of the car.
Yeah, I would like to shout out, by the way, being from Foster City, California, Dan Aykroyd does mention the San Mateo Bridge, which drops you off in Foster City. And I always, when I was a kid, I got so excited that they were going to go over the San Mateo Bridge, but they don't. Unfortunately, the sounds of the thumping were not appropriate.
It's the other bridge. It's the fourth bridge.
It's the Dumbarton, yeah.
Because there's only four bridges in the Bay Area, apparently.
And he didn't hear the foghorn, so it couldn't have been the Golden Gate.
What did you think about the film's use of the Bay Area locations? Did it bring out a sense of the San Francisco you know?
You know, I mean, there's very little actually shot in San Francisco. You know, there's the scene where Redford meets up with Timothy Busfield to give him the answering machine, and that's outside. And there are a couple exterior shots.
When they drop him off after Ben Kingsley's threatening him with prison, they drop him off on a hill. That overlooks
the
Alcatraz.
Bay. Yeah. So, I mean, San Francisco is, to me, and this is probably biased, but is the most recognizable city on film. Like, I mean, you could shoot, my girlfriend and I were talking about this a few days ago, you could shoot anywhere in San Francisco and I'll know instantly that it's San Francisco, because it just has this iconic and a very original topography that just doesn't, you know, it's no other city. So, you know, I get a little, you know, twinge of excitement every time I see something like that, and it takes me back to home and stuff. But yeah, it didn't really take. There wasn't that much set in San Francisco. You know, like you said, those are like the two shots. Most of this is interiors. You know, office buildings and their warehouse loft type place where they, you know, hatch their schemes and stuff like that. You know, but it is nice to, you know, just as, you know, trip down memory lane. Sure, it's always nice to see something like that, but. The film before this that Phil Alden Robinson did, which I think is the film that was, you know, gave him a pass to get Robert Redford and all these other people for this thing, is Field of Dreams, which I believe was the year before.
A few years before. Few Field of Dreams, I think it's 89.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. And then I think Robin, he just kind of disappeared.
Phil Alden Robinson?
Yeah. I mean, he kind of just dropped off the map there.
Well, and you know, Field of Dreams also is very much about baby boomer politics and getting old and becoming less radical as you get old, and just kind of this whole generation selling out. In Field of Dreams, they're trying to get back to this more kind of American roots and reconnecting with your father through baseball, using baseball as a conduit for a generation which had rejected a lot of basic American values to try and get back to that. Whereas Sneakers, these baby boomers are, you know, becoming enamored with technological gadgets, with computers and electronics. And then they're also, you know, just becoming, you know, more accustomed to just basic creature comforts. Like when they have the chance to ask for their reward at the end.
Right.
After they've, you know, saved the day. Dan Aykroyd asks for a Winnebago.
Right.
And all through the movie, he's like this radical conspiracy theorist about everything. Like, the government has killed everything. Like, the government, you know, shot JFK, but he's still alive.
Right, right. He's got, yeah, he ties in, and Pete Rose's scandal was, right. Yeah.
Right. But all he wants is a mobile home.
Well, and, but he might want the mobile home so that he can go off the grid and just disappear and, you know.
He wants a kitchen.
Well, he doesn't.
He wants the full-size kitchen.
Yeah, the kitchen
so
is
he
the,
can eat a lot.
Yeah, the kitchen is the selling point.
Sidney Poitier wants to go on vacation with his wife.
Right.
You know, River Phoenix just wants the phone number of the NSA agent.
The cute NSA agent.
Yeah. And you know, David Strathairn asks for, like, the hippie ideal of, like, peace on Earth.
Right.
And, you know, everyone laughs at him.
Yeah. Well, he's the
because
magic.
That's ridiculous.
He's the magic blind man.
All right, that's our discussion of Sneakers, a fun if implausible film of questionable political value. We're going to take a little break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the news of the week, Robert Redford, and hacker movies. For now, let's listen to some Pavement.
Language of influence is cluttered with hot. See, and I put a spark him in a Creoles in Vermont. There's no coast of Nebraska. My mother, I forgot. Slavic princess with a rose in her teeth. Do you suppose she would bite you if she could? Instant coldness with the wood. Traitor of the Lambrine. Call her Jimmy.
Okay, that was some Pavement for you, taking you back to 1997. There's some news this week. Film festivals are gearing up for their...
The big film festivals of the fall are starting to announce their lineups.
Mm-hmm.
Toronto and Venice and Locarno have all started putting out what movies they're putting out, but... Mostly, I'm excited for the Vancouver Film Festival, which I got my my train ticket and my hotel reservations made this week, so I'm looking forward to that. They haven't announced what movies they're going to play yet, though.
Oh, really? I heard all Johnny Toe.
That would be pretty great.
Yeah.
Of what has been announced for the upcoming film festivals, I haven't seen a whole lot that I'm really excited for. What I'm hoping makes it to Vancouver is the new Johnny Toe movie, Blind Detective. Jajanka's martial arts movie, A Touch of Sin, I'm really looking forward to. And there should be one or two new Hong Sang-soo films coming out this fall also. or three. I'm not sure. The guy just keeps churning them out.
Just keeps cranking them out.
But, yeah, have you seen anything from Toronto or Venice lineup so far that has struck your fancy?
I haven't had a chance to really... I've been on vacation for a week, so I haven't had a chance to look at any schedules myself. But I think the new Coens is opening there.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that. The new Paul Haggis is, though. So.
You know what's funny is I was going to talk about this later in the show. I just finished last night Lawrence Wright, the New Yorker writer's book on Scientology, Going Clear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the wraparound thing in it is Haggis's defection from Scientology.
Right.
And I'm actually going to tie this in with Whirlpool later, so maybe we can talk about it then. But it's a fantastic book. I recommend it highly. What are you pointing at? Oh, the new Jim Jarmusch movie is playing at the Toronto International Film Festival,
yeah.
Which is my third most anticipated movie of this year, Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yeah, it's a vampire movie with Tilda Swinton. And how has Tilda Swinton not played a vampire before now?
I know. It's like the most genius thing in the world, is it not?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So yeah, also coming out, or also in the news this week, Richard Brody from The New Yorker riffing on a 20-year-old Jonathan Rosenbaum article came up with his list of the 12 greatest living directors. Those are people who have had like the most impact on film, and not necessarily, you know, just his personal favorites, but the ones he thinks are, you know, great. His list includes some choices that would not make our list. I know he has Wes Anderson on there, and I am a huge Wes Anderson fan. You, Mike, are not.
I'm not. I mean, I knew this was going to come up one of these days on the show, but, you know, maybe I'm getting a little enough distance from my experiences with Wes Anderson. I've only seen the first three Wes Anderson films. And I hate them so much that I never went any further. You know what's funny about Wes Anderson, though, is when I tell people that I don't like his films, everybody without fail, they say, you know, I give them all my complaints about how the characters are, you know, just a bunch of quirks. And, you know, I mean, he does do some things really well. And I admit that he's, you know, he's really good at, you know, visual composition. I mean, that's really great. But anyway, not to get into this whole long discussion about this again, but I give all my reasons for not liking Wes Anderson, and almost without fail, everybody says, I totally know what you mean, but there's this one movie of his you need to see, but it's always a different movie. Like, someone will be like, yeah, I totally hear that, like, I really didn't care for Rushmore, but Life Aquatic, oh, it's, you know, or Fantastic Mr. And I'm like, if it was the same movie over and over again, if everybody was like, okay, Fantastic Mr. Fox, that's the one, then I give it a shot. But it seems like it's all over the map, and I don't have time for that guy. I really don't have time for that guy.
That's fine.
Anyway, sorry, what were we talking about?
I feel much the same way about several directors, like Lars von Trier or Michael Haneke, or, you know, there's people you just don't click with.
Yeah.
I happen to love each and every Wes Anderson movie, and they get better every time I see them. So.
Yeah, well.
So we thought that was an interesting idea. So we came up very quickly with our own top 12 most greatest living narrative filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is definitive, people.
Yeah, this is definitive. We put it together 5 minutes before we started recording this. We're probably forgetting several very obvious people, but this is, you know, the definitive 5 minutes before the recording of the George Sanders Show greatest living filmmakers of right now.
The Louis Anderson Show. Okay.
All right.
So we'll start with the ones that we agree with Richard Brody, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He has Terrence Malick.
I'll agree with that.
Alain Resnais.
I'll agree with that.
Jean-Luc Godard.
Yep.
And Abbas Kiarostami.
Sure.
We agree with all of those. On Jonathan Rosenbaum's original list is Ho Sha Shen, which he would probably be my number one. If I had to rank these,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're a Ho fan.
I am a Ho fan. I do need to see more of his work, though.
So that's five. Hayao Miyazaki.
That was the first pick for me. That just jumped right to my head because he's had a singular career, and he's the quality has never waned, in my opinion.
John Ito, obviously. Can't leave out Johnny Toe.
Is this the second Johnny Toe reference in the show? It's the second one in this segment, actually,
yeah.
As a matter of fact.
Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese, I think it's pretty hard to argue with their influence. I happen to think they're both pretty great filmmakers also.
I think they're fantastic. I one of them will be mentioned later in the show.
And then we have David Lynch, Werner Herzog, and Wong Kar-wai.
Yep.
So I think we agree on all of those. Basically, what we're saying is that Richard Brody is wrong.
Absolutely.
And these are the inarguable 12 greatest living 12
greatest
filmmakers, according to the 5 minutes of research we did before starting the show.
They're out back from George Sanders Central here. We have people inscribing these names onto stone tablets, and we will be placing them in front of courthouses.
Yeah, if nothing else, I am certain that all 12 of these people are currently living.
Okay, well, with that squared away, we're going to go into another definitive list here. We're going to talk about Cinema Essentials, where we pick a film each week that kind of defines a genre or a theme or what have you. And this week, tying in with Sneakers, we're talking about...
it ties in with Whirlpool as well.
It does tie in with Whirlpool, yeah, as well.
Because you could say that Jean Tierney, her brain gets hacked.
Gets hacked. We are talking about hacker films, which is a genre that really came into its own in the early 90s.
Sneakers is one of the first, you know, of the new wave of like internet hacker movies. Like, there were a couple of earlier examples, but
yeah.
Sneakers kind of kicked it off.
Yeah, it definitely, yeah, and, you know, it's got some really quintessential lines, you know, Ben Kingsley at the end says, it's not about the money or the power, it's who controls the information.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you probably don't remember this because you were, like, 12 at the time, or 11, but the information superhighway was, like, the buzzword of 1992, like, everyone was talking about it,
I grew up in Silicon Valley with a computer programming older brother. I know all about this information superhighway.
Yeah.
I think it's a series of tubes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about our choices for the Cinema Essential hacker film. What do you think is the one that shines above them all, Sean?
I'm going back to the beginning. I'm going old school with 1983's War Games, starring Matthew Broderick as a computer hacker with one of those modems that you put, like, the telephone receiver onto the modem, and that's how you get onto the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses this modem to break into the Strategic Air Command's base in this mountain in NORAD, and he starts playing with the computer, and he's playing tic-tac-toe, and he's playing chess, and then he plays this new game called Global Thermonuclear War. But the computer doesn't know it's a game. It's going to actually launch its nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union. So
right.
Matthew Broderick's got to, like, race to the mountain and convince the computer
not to do it. Yeah, that's a great pick. I mean, you know, there aren't, I mean, maybe there are a lot, I just don't remember any of them, because most of these movies were pretty disposable and they obviously are of their time, but War Games obviously is one that kind of sticks in your head.
You know, I actually just saw it a couple of years ago, and it holds up. It's a really good movie. It's directed by John Badham, who is a legitimately competent director, like you know, like whoever made Johnny Mnemonic.
Legitimately competent.
You know, John Badham did Saturday Night Fever. He did Short Circuit.
Ooh, Short Circuit. Well, there you go.
He did the La Femme Nikita remake, Point of No Return.
Oh, and he did Nick of Time.
Yeah, Nick of Time is a terrible movie. With Johnny Depp and Christopher Walken. Anyway, yeah, he has a long career. Unlike a fellow Alan Robinson, who
right.
only made like a handful of movies and disappeared.
Yeah.
Like, John Badham is was a solid director.
Yeah. My pick is not a very good film, but I think it's a very influential film. I don't think it's War Games level. I don't think it's Sneakers level. You know, I mean, push comes to shove, I'd probably say Sneakers is my Cinema Essential pick, but that's lame. I'm not going to do that. What I'm actually going with is the 1982 film Tron from Disney, which, you know, the thing about Tron...
Not Tron Legacy.
I did not see Tron Legacy. I have no desire to see Tron Legacy. I'm not. Tron is not a good movie. I saw it on a double feature maybe 5 or 6 years ago in Monterey, California. I saw it on a double feature with Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with Kirk Douglas, which is actually a pretty fun movie. That movie holds up. And Tron does not so well. But for the future of film, the next 30 years, you know, there was no movie like Tron when Tron came out. I mean, it is a really, you know, visually...
Yeah, it was a pioneer in computer graphics.
In computer graphics. And it influenced, you know, a whole spate of directors, including John Lasseter and the people that went on to form Pixar. They saw this movie and they said, oh my gosh, we could think of the possibilities of what we can do with this.
Yeah.
You know, it's a campy, fun movie, you know, with Jeff Bridges is in it, and, you know, he's always a lot of fun. But he's mostly a lot of fun. I don't know about this RIPD thing that just came out and tanked, but, you know. I think he's supposed to be doing his Rooster Cogburn thing by killing zombies or whatever. But
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't.
There's a reason we're talking about sneakers this week.
That's, that's true. But, you know, Tron is worth a watch. It's a little tedious there, and there's a lot of scenes of, you know, two electronic motorbikes going across a grid and stuff. But seeing it on the big screen was definitely a fun experience.
I don't think I've seen it in 30 years,
yeah.
but I do remember going to see it in the theater when I was 6 or 7 years old. I remember I went with my mom, and she and I went to Tron, and my aunt and uncle and like other more grown-up members of our family went to see On Golden Pond. And it's been 30 years since I've seen it, but I'm pretty sure my mom and I got the better end of that theater.
I think you did.
Yeah.
There could be a mashup on Golden Tron, which I would definitely pay to see. So that's my pick, Tron from 1982. I think they're making a third one, too.
Yeah.
Tron Ulysses.
I think it's interesting that we both pick movies from the early 80s.
Yeah. Well, you know. What are you going to do? Are you going to pick Johnny Mnemonic? The Lawnmower Man?
Well, you know, The Matrix would be another obvious pick, but you haven't seen The Matrix.
I haven't seen The Matrix. You want to know why I haven't seen The Matrix? I actually have a reason to.
Because it's a really good movie.
I know, I expect to
and
like
I'm
it.
I'm really mad at you about not seeing it.
Here's the thing. I have two brothers, one older, one younger, and they are kind of more tech-savvy people. They play computer games. They have LAN parties, you know, where they drink Mountain Dew and stay up for 48 hours.
Is that still a thing that people do?
They did at some point. I don't know what's going on. I don't know. I don't pay attention. But anyway, they saw The Matrix, I think opening week in 99. And they didn't know what they were getting into like most people when, you know, Matrix came out. It was, you know, not really talked about that much. And they loved it. And it became this kind of bonding moment for my brothers that I was excluded from because I wasn't there for the first screening, and that, you know.
So The Matrix makes you feel sad?
No. It's
makes
but
you feel like you're not part of your family.
No, that's not it at all. The thing with The Matrix to me is that it feels like it's something that's special for my brothers, and that if I try and tap into that now, I've missed the boat and da da da. I will see it one of these days, but it's got all this weight behind it from them seeing it. I think they actually saw it, and my older brother Sean, turned to my younger brother Christopher after the movie ended, and he said, "You want to watch it again?" And I think they saw it again that day.
Yeah, I saw it a few times. It played at the Neptune.
Yeah,
it was very popular.
Yeah,
I was really excited to see it because it was by the directors of Bound.
I have seen Bound,
because
I'm all about lesbian caper.
Which I had seen because Roger Ebert had it as like one of his best movies of the year, so I made a point of checking it out, and it's a really good heist caper movie.
It is a very good movie. Yeah, I do quite enjoy that. Have you seen any of their? You saw Speed Racer.
Yeah, Speed Racer I like a lot. They produced V for Vendetta, which is okay. Cloud Atlas they directed. It's also okay.
Yeah. The book's kind of just
The Matrix sequels aren't all that good. There's like good stuff in them. One of my favorite things about The Matrix is the fight choreography is by Wen Woping, who was a Hong Kong action director and filmmaker dating from like the early 70s. He did the original, or the late 70s, I guess. He did the original Drunken Master with Jackie Chan. And
wasn't he doing the choreography on The Grandmaster too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with the success of The Matrix, he became like the number one like action guy in the world, and every action film after that would try to hire Wen Woping. He did Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, he did the Kill Bill movies, and it became he became trendy, and which was really cool. It was just kind of Hong Kong filmmaking entering the mainstream of Hollywood, not by, you know, stars like Chow Yun-fat or directors like John Woo who had tried to make it, but through action choreography. And then it all went away as people realized that it was easier to just chop your action scenes up into little tiny bits, and then people would think that something exciting had happened.
Yeah.
So that, you know, then we get the Bourne movies and Paul Greengrass just cutting everything to hell, or Michael Bay movies where the camera swishes around and cuts.
Or Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
Ugh. Well, so I don't know how we got. Like I don't know how we got here.
There was this little like 5-year golden age where Wen Wo-Ping like was the dominant action aesthetic in the world, and then it went away.
Well, you know, all good things can't last.
Yeah,
yeah.
But we've digressed way off the subject.
We've really digressed,
and we should talk about somebody who is not much of an action star.
No, he's not.
He would not mesh well with Wen Wo-Ping. But he is a symbol of all things baby boomer, and that is Mr. Robert Redford. So, Mike, what do you think of Robert Redford?
You know, I enjoy Robert Redford in films. You know, I think in Sneakers, he does a wonderful job. There are a couple of little moments where he does this double take early in the film. I don't remember the context of it, but it's really subtle, and it's just... you know, a really cute little throwaway thing that he does. And it works. And he definitely knows how he looks on camera. He knows how to sell stuff.
He's a very handsome man.
He's a handsome guy.
And there's kind of two distinct things I think about the Robert Redford star persona. He's the handsome guy who is unhappy that he's so handsome because things come so easily to him and he doesn't like that. And That's basically his character in The Way We Were, which I just saw for the first time a few weeks ago. It was my first Barbra Streisand movie. Speaking of...
congratulations.
Symbols of baby boomer liberal activism. So he's the pretty boy with unsuspected depth. He's always smarter than you would think he would be. He was never like a nimbo. Is that still a word?
We're bringing it back.
Do people still have nimbos?
We're talking metrosexual. We're bringing it all back on this show, my friend.
Anyway, and then as he got older, he kind of shifted into the handsome, mysterious guy who couldn't commit to the woman who loved him. And that's his character in, like, Out of Africa or Havana. And it's somewhat his character in Sneakers, where the Mary McDonnell character... resists getting involved with him because she's been down that road before and he's not a one-woman man. He's
right.
A loner.
Well, isn't he in this... is he in a third phase now where he's in kind of like liberal, small like liberal activist pictures that nobody sees?
Yeah, that's what he's doing as a filmmaker. Like,
Lions for Lambs.
As he got into the 80s, he became more of a director than an actor. And I think he's actually a pretty good director. Ordinary People won a bunch of Oscars, and it's a pretty good, you know, kind of family melodrama. Quiz Show I like more than I probably should. there's just something about Quiz Show that it has just really always appealed to me, just this kind of world of the 50s and the intellectual world of like the Mark Van Dorens contrasted with the more upstart world of the Rob Morrow character, even though Rob Morrow's Boston accent is absolutely horrible. And you know, John Turturro also trying to break into this kind of waspy intellectual world through this new medium. I like that movie a lot.
That's okay.
The Milagro Beanfield War I saw once, and I remember it being a lot of fun, even though it's got a terrible title.
I've never heard of that movie.
Yeah.
When's that from?
It's from the late 80s, I think, like 88.
Well, he's supposed to be... There's that new movie where it's just him on a boat in a storm or something. All is Lost, I think, that just played at some festivals.
I have no idea what that is.
It's a film... I mean, I just heard a little bit, but it I don't think... He didn't direct it. He's just starring in it, but he's a sailor, and he's trapped out in the ocean by himself. It sounds like Castaway mixed with A Perfect Storm or something like that.
Okay.
And it's supposed to be—he's supposed to be just riveting this thing. He barely speaks a line, but he's—he's in it and he's fighting the elements, and it's—you know—he's—he's.
Yeah, he's, I don't know if he's a really great actor. He's a great star.
He's a great presence.
He has, he has this like really magnetic presence whenever he's on camera.
Absolutely.
And his best roles kind of use that.
Well, let me ask you, what's your favorite Robert Redford film, like performance-wise, like film that he's in, should I say?
Favorite film that he's in is probably The Sting.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is another caper film.
Uh-huh.
And it just kind of plays off of his charm and also his prettiness and his intelligence.
Mm-hmm. It's a crackerjack film.
Yeah, it kind of lets him use all of his traits as a movie star.
Yeah.
Whereas like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, he's more being taciturn.
Mm-hmm.
And then in later films, he's just kind of being self-pitying.
Yeah.
Like I like Out of Africa, but his character is a little ridiculous.
We should talk a little bit about his stuff outside of, you know, starring and directing pictures. You know, he's, you know, is responsible for Sundance.
Right, which has had, you know, probably an aggregate positive effect on the film industry.
Now, Sean, you need to promise me you're not going to just whine like you did last week on the show.
Sundance is fine. It gives a lot of filmmakers a lot of, you know, opportunities and has done a lot to support independent film, and that's a good thing. More people making movies is always a good thing.
Yeah, and Sundance has been spun off into, you know, a theater chain that's kind of, you know, just starting to get traction out, you know.
Yeah, they now own
our old stomping ground. The Metro is now a Sundance Cinema in Seattle. You haven't been there yet, have you?
I have not.
Yeah, I have not either. Yeah, so he does positive things.
Yeah.
You know, he's not hurting people. He's not Harvey Weinstein.
No, he's not.
He's not cutting movies. With that, that's our discussion of Robert Redford.
We're going to listen to a little clip from Otto Preminger's film Whirlpool, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Yeah, we are.
But I can't possibly become a patient of yours.
You are already. The fact that I know of your kleptomania, the fact that I know that your mind is sick and threatening to get out of hand, gives me a medical position in your life, doesn't it?
Yes, I suppose it does.
You're relaxed with me. You don't have to exhaust yourself trying to seem normal. The serene and devoted wife who doesn't dare upset her busy husband. Your soul can undress in front of me. That means that your cure is already beginning. I can make you sleep. Every night. 9 hours of peaceful, happy sleep.
How?
Trust me. Look at me. There are no thoughts in your mind, no fears. Trust me, I can help you. Don't think of anything. Forget. There is nothing to remember. Just close your eyes and forget. Forget.
All right, that was Otto Preminger's 1949 film noir Whirlpool, in which Jean Tierney plays a housewife who's also a kleptomaniac, and she falls into the hypnotic clutches of Jose Ferrar, who frames her for murder, and it's up to her husband, a psychiatrist played by Richard Conti, to crack the case and set
clear
his wife
name.
Free.
Yes.
Clear her name. What did you think of Whirlpool, Mike?
I enjoyed Whirlpool. It's fun. I think the best thing in it is Jose Ferrar. He's really perfect as this slimy hypnotist, and his voice is just, which you can hear in that clip there, you know, those dulcet tones that he uses, and he's just, you know,
it's mesmeric.
I was mesmerized, Sean. He really, for me, carried the picture, and part of it is that, you know, the screenplay co-written by Ben Hecht, who worked with everybody, Hitchcock, and
one of the greatest screenwriters of all time.
Yeah, easily. He gives Ferrar all these great lines. I mean, there's so many great things in the, you know, I quoted one on Letterboxd, and he's got one line in the film where he says, you know, I bow to your abysmal scruples, you know, stuff like that. And he's just,
yeah, I wrote that one down too.
He's having a lot of fun, you know, and he also, what I like about him too is his character is blatantly a jerk. I mean, he calls everybody stupid around him. You know, I mean, I think he says stupid like 15 times in this movie.
Yeah, he's wildly unpleasant.
He's wildly but he still has this power, you know, that he wields, you know, to get, you know, to fleece women and to, you know.
Yeah, he's short, he's bald, he's funny looking.
Yeah.
Yet he's in control of every interaction.
Yeah, every interaction in this movie. So he to me, he's my favorite part of the film. But yeah, I thought it was, you know, it was really well made. It definitely feels like a film, speaking of how Sneakers is a film of 1992 or early 90s, you know, this feels really like a late 40s, you know, post-war kind of thing. And this is, you know, earlier I was talking about the Scientology thing, and I was reading about how, you know, L. Ron Hubbard's, you know, schemes, I will call them that, started to really gain traction around the same time, where people coming back from the war were kind of, you know, dealing with PTSD types of things.
Right, as we see in The Master.
Exactly, yeah. We see in Paul Thomas Anderson's Master. And so a lot of these, you know, different ways of mapping the mind or, you know, calming people or, you know, getting rid of bad thoughts and stuff play out in this movie where you've got, you know, a hypnotist who's you know, manipulating someone's mind who detests, you know, psychoanalysis. And, you know, there's this kind of war between Richard Conti's, you know, doctor, you know.
Right, and analysis also becoming extremely popular in the United States in the post-war period.
Exactly. So it feels like it really feels like that era. You know, this movie wouldn't really work 10, 15, 20 years later or, you know, as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think also, you know, talking about the post-war period, it has a lot to say about gender relations in the family.
Mm-hmm.
In the immediate post-war era, where, you know, during the war, women had been out of the home and hadn't been getting jobs, and then the men come back from the war, and the women are expected to go back into the home and be housewives,
right,
and not, you know, not work, not do anything. Their whole, you know, purpose was as a, you know, a mother and a homemaker.
Exactly.
And obviously that would be very traumatic for the women, you know, pushed back into the home. And I think, you know, the film really explores that with the hypnotism device being a kind of literalization of the kind of patriarchal control that the woman, in this case Jean Tierney, is put back under when she's, you know, forced to be the wife to her husband,
right,
who gets to go out and be a job and,
right,
be a doctor or,
right,
professor, whereas she's nothing else. And it ties in the film with her backstory and the origin of her kleptomania, which is explained as like a reaction to her relationship with her father.
Yeah.
Her father was very controlling, and the only way that she could act out and act independently was to steal things.
Mm-hmm.
Like her only reaction against patriarchy was to violate property rights. Which is kind of fascinating. And then, you know, she got better as she went on. She went to college, she led her own life. And then when she got married, she found herself back in the same situation where her husband wasn't letting her do all of the things that she wanted to do, mostly spend money.
So I'm going to go steal a necklace.
So she would steal, and it would be kind,
yeah,
of this outlet for this repression that she felt, like the little kleptomania would make her feel better about her oppressive situation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Which you know, makes this movie more than just, you know, film noir, we need to clear her name kind of thing, you know, by the book, you know, kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of things going on here.
Well, the best film noirs function not just as like simple, you know, suspense stories or whodunits or mysteries, but there's always this other level of things going on.
Yes.
And there's one of the peculiar things about Preminger as a director is that it's not really a subtext. Like, this is, you know, directly explained in the film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That, you know, she says, I'm the kleptomaniac
because
my father was mean to me, and then my husband was mean to me, and that's why I do things.
Yes.
Like, there's not a lot that's hidden in a Preminger movie. He pretty much lays everything out there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's an interesting approach, and it tends to kind of make him undervalued by, you know, kind of cinephiles who are first getting into movies and looking for, like, hidden symbolic meanings.
Sure, sure. I think it's actually a pretty brave thing to be doing, especially at that time.
Yeah, you know, and Andrew Saris and I'm sure other people have talked about the kind of directness of Preminger's approach as related to his family background. He comes from a prominent family of lawyers in Austria. Like, his father was like the equivalent of an attorney general in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
So he very much lays things out there like a lawyer would, presenting his case. He just puts everything out in the open and leads it to the audience to construct it. And you know, many of Preminger's best movies have to do with the law. Like, my favorite is Anatomy of Murder,
mm-hmm.
with Jimmy Stewart, which is a courtroom drama. Which, you know, the antics in the courtroom don't really seem very realistic, but it's a really fascinating movie about the law and about the kind of the lawyer's imperative to defend their client, whether or not they think they're guilty or innocent. Because Stewart never knows if his client is guilty or not.
Mm-hmm.
He has a couple of theories, but it doesn't affect how he prosecutes the defense.
Right. He does his job.
Prosecutes the defense.
Defends the prosecute.
Right.
Yeah. What did you think about the relationship between Tierney and Conti in this? Did you, because to me, that was the least engaging part of the whole film. I thought that, you know, their relationship, I didn't really buy into it. There didn't seem to be anything there, really. And I felt like there were, you know, secondary characters who were more interesting and had, you know, better storylines.
I think Jean Tierney was a great movie star. She's one of my favorite actresses, but she's very limited
uh-huh.
as an actress.
Uh-huh.
Like, she is best in this movie in the scenes where she's hypnotized.
I agree.
That's because Jean Tierney is great at being a blank shell.
Yeah, I agree.
There are a few movies where she actually relates very warmly to other human beings,
uh-huh.
Like The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, or you know, even Heaven Can Wait.
Mm-hmm.
But more often she functions in a film better as a symbol.
Sure.
And that's the case in this movie, I think, and also in Preminger's Laura, which is probably Otto Preminger's most famous film and Jean Tierney's most famous performance,
mm-hmm.
where she spends the first half of the film as a painting.
Yeah. But what a painting she is.
Yeah.
yeah, well, for me, I really liked this, the character of the lieutenant. Charles Bickford plays this mm-hmm. lieutenant. He's this gruff, you know, older guy who's, you know, he gives Conti all these chances to kind of clear Tierney's name, and he doesn't
like Jose Ferrar.
Yeah,
and he's not convinced that Jean Tierney is guilty.
And we find out, you know, initially we just think, oh, he's just a, you know, gruff lieutenant, you know, who's, you know, he's just doing his job or whatever. But then we find out that his wife died, you know, a month before, and he's actually, you kind of see how grief-stricken he is. And one of my favorite scenes in the entire film is when he decides to take Conti to the house where the murder has taken place, and he's lying in bed at night, and he wakes up, and, you know, you can tell he's been thinking about this as he can't sleep and stuff, and he looks at his bedside, and there's the picture of his departed wife. You know, it's a little, you know, obvious or whatever, but
the detective's house is very feminine. Like, it's got this flowery lamp on his bedside,
mm-hmm.
and this kind of big ruffle, and when he meets Richard Conti there, they meet in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's doing the dishes and all those things, and and it really, you know, It's this little side, you know, avenue or whatever, showing this guy's heartbreak over the death of his wife and how he's willing to translate that into helping Conti, you know, get his wife back from, you know, prison where,
right.
you know, where she's being held. And I really, really enjoyed that that character and that, you know, the way he's written. And also Bickford plays him really well, too.
You know, another interesting aspect of the film is how it functions as a film noir. Normally in a film noir, you have like a hero
mm-hmm.
who made a mistake in their past, and now they've become caught up in some kind of conspiracy against them. They become a victim because of something they did wrong
mm-hmm.
once. And often they'll get involved with a femme fatale who kind of leads them down this path of destruction. The genders are reversed in Whirlpool,
mm-hmm.
where it's Tierney who has the past, and it's her past as a kleptomaniac that makes her susceptible to the manipulations of the femme fatale figure, who's Jose Ferrar.
Right.
So instead of, like, the man being the victim of the woman, it's the woman being the victim of the man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, it feels different. You know, I mean, you know, film noir, you know, there's so many different types and all that stuff. But, yeah, this, it almost doesn't even feel like a film noir at times to me. You know, it's got the trappings of the genre and stuff, but
it's as much a melodrama as it is a crime film. It's like the intersection between something like Out of the Past or Double Indemnity and a Douglas Sirk movie, All That Heaven Allows.
Yeah.
And you know, noirs are crime melodramas, so there's a lot of going back and forth. Like Douglas Sirk made films noir in the 1940s. It even, you know, harkens back to earlier crime films, like the when Tierney is finally confessing to her husband that she's a kleptomaniac. The phrase she uses is "I stole," which is the very famous last line of the 1930s movie "I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang," where the hero is like wrongfully sent to a chain gang and he's abused by the prison system for years and years and years, and finally he escapes. But the only way he can survive is by actually becoming a thief. And someone, you know, like this girl asks him how he's surviving, and his face like pokes out of the darkness and says, "I stole," and then goes back, and that's where the movie ends.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's the society making him a criminal.
Sure.
Through the abuses of the justice system.
The film work here from Preminger, he does some really great, there's that tracking shot where when Tierney is hypnotized and she goes into the household where the dead body is, and there's this tracking shot that shows her putting these vinyl records of, I forget that character's name, who's the Teresa Randolph. Is the
victim.
The victim, who also has a past with Jose Ferrar's character, and he wants her out of the picture. So he kills her and then hypnotizes Tierney to go to the house and be caught there by the police. And the camera follows her from this closet upstairs. And she goes down into this den, and the camera goes around this fireplace. And you see the fire's burning, and there's this giant portrait of Randolph. Another portrait in a
Preminger film.
Exactly, you know. And it's just a swooping shot, and then it comes down and you see the body, and it's just really dramatic, and just, it's not too flashy, you know. It doesn't really call attention to itself, but it's a really, you know, masterful little swoop there.
What struck me most about his visual style was you know, we ostensibly picked this because of its location. Because the Wikipedia list said it was set in San Francisco, and it's not set in San Francisco. It's set in Los Angeles.
Yes.
But it's not really set in Los Angeles either. It's set almost entirely in interior spaces.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I think there's one shot outside in the film, and it's when Tierney is hypnotized and when she's driving up to Terry's house.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only time we actually see the exterior of a building, or we see any of the characters outside. Everything else is inside a hotel, inside an apartment, inside the jail.
Mm-hmm.
There's no establishing shots of the streets outside. It all takes place in inner spaces. Like, you know, there's in a domestic space, like the issues with her being a housewife, and also the interior of her own brain as she gets, you know, manipulated by her husband, maybe, and also
Jose Ferrar.
Definitely Jose Ferrar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the worst possible movie we could have picked for movies set in San Francisco, because not only is there only one scene in San Francisco, you never see the outside.
Yeah, you don't. You really don't. But it's not a bad movie.
No, not at all.
It's quite fun.
Okay, so that's Whirlpool. We're going to take a listen to another Pavement song, all about the war between Northern and Southern California, and then we'll be back to wrap up the show.
All right.
Yeah.
That was Unfair, a wonderful song by the great band Pavement. We want to thank Stephen Malkmus and the gang for not suing us for playing this music today on the show. Next week, we will be talking about... We tie things in with movies that are coming out. And, you know, summertime, it's not the right time for us, really. But next week, on August 2nd, there's a Denzel Washington, Marky Mark Wahlberg film called Two Guns coming out.
And also The Smurfs 2.
Oh, and The Smurfs 2 as well. I forgot about that. So there are two films with 2 in the title.
On the 2nd.
On the 2nd. So what we're going to do the same thing. Except we're going to talk about Francois Truffaut's Two English Girls. And we're going to talk about Two Lovers from 2008, the James Gray film.
Yes, we are. We're also going to talk about the career of Francois Truffaut and our Cinema Central love triangles.
Yeah, it's going to be steamy. If you are in Chicago this week, on the 27th, Saturday the 27th, and then 29th, Monday, the Gene Siskel Film Center is going to be showing AI, Artificial Intelligence, Steven Spielberg's film that you and I both agree is a fantastic film, right?
Definitely. It's one of Spielberg's best.
Yeah, which I think it doesn't get the recognition that it deserves. I think a lot of people don't care for it so much.
Those people are wrong.
If you're in Chicago, you should go see it because it is really, really good. Do you have a recommendation this week?
Yeah, if you're in New York, starting next Friday the 2nd, you've got to go see Intolerance playing at the Film Forum. It's a D.W. Griffith's massive epic that was kind of a response to criticism of Birth of a Nation by saying that you know, he says that Intolerance is bad, which it's always been unclear to me whether he thinks that the intolerance of the Ku Klux Klan was bad or the people who were intolerant of the racism he put in Birth of a Nation were bad.
It's kind of like Orson Scott Card's thing right now where, you know, there's this boycott of the Ender's Game movie that's coming out because Orson Scott Card is homophobic and a total bigot and stuff. And he put out this statement where he says, hopefully the groups that disagree with me will, you know, be less intolerant of my opinion or whatever.
Anyway, Intolerance isn't, you know, so much about intolerance, but it is, you know, four different stories set in four different time periods and intercut altogether. And this was made in 1916, so it's one of the seminal landmarks in film history. It's got a story set in ancient Babylonia, a passion story. There's one set in the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre with the killing of the Huguenots in France. And then there's a modern-day story, which, you know, isn't modern anymore because it was 100 years ago.
Right.
But it's a great, massive, epic, fascinating movie.
Unfortunately, I'm only familiar with Three Ages, the Buster Keaton film that is a parody of Intolerance. Yes.
It's also a great movie, but it is not playing at Film Forum. They really should have considered that as a double feature, though.
That would have been really cool. So until next week, you can find us on the internet at thegeorgesandersshow.blogspot.com. We're also on the Twitter at geosandersshow, and we also have an email address, thegeorgesandersshow@gmail.com. So until next week, here's George.
Kiss is just a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time.